Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. I've been watching a lot of movies on YouTube.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because, hey, free.
Free is good.
Yeah. It's funny how now that big screen TVs are getting cheaper, that I now watch movies on like a little, tiny little corner of my computer monitor as I'm doing other things. But
yeah, but it's like as you're doing other things. Like I do that when I'm doing freelance stuff, you know?
Sure. Absolutely. So I saw Brooklyn's Finest, which was okay, by the director, I think, who did Training Day. But I've also been watching these comedies from the early 2000s.
Okay.
Such as?
Oh.
Apparently none he can remember.
Yeah, because you don't watch the whole movie. You watch a little bit and see if it's going to be worth watching a little bit more. And then as soon as it hits a lull, you just kind of skip.
Like, kind of like porn.
Yeah, except you don't get any satisfaction out of it. You know? You walk away cleaner, but I guess less satisfied.
You can also watch it when your girlfriend's home.
Yeah, that's true. Now, what was it? Just a Friend? Maybe with Ryan Reynolds? That was one of them.
It also sounds like porn.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking that too.
Sorry.
Oh, because Ryan Reynolds?
Why,
oh. Oh, yeah.
The title.
Sounds like my idea of dream porn. It starts promisingly enough, but yeah, then it gets pretty boring. And then there was other ones. One's called Pig, and that was pretty bad. I don't know. You just get kind of jump, give it 2 minutes, see if it's going to get any better, and it won't. So you just jump again. Mm.
So if any movie people are listening, comedies in the future should be all jokes all the time. Otherwise, Lyle will skip your movie.
Yeah.
Well, it is a comedy.
Not everything can be funny all the time. You got to have that low point so that things get funny again.
And then you can, where it's heartfelt and you learn something.
Mm-hmm.
Where the girl finds a guy and then it's a romantic comedy. Or porn.
Yeah, these were like romantic comedies.
There's your problem. 90s romantic comedies. The fun.
All right, see if you get through Just a Friend.
Oh, what is this, a challenge?
Don't wish to try.
It's a drinking game if you get through it. Just have a drink, because you earned it.
Is it hard if I just drink to get through it?
My fake Kickstarter stuff showed up.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's pretty much like right after we recorded the last week's episode, so I have stopped reading Numenera and started reading Fate Core.
And? How is it?
I've only gotten through the first chapter. Just started character creation. Mm-hmm. So far, I'm really liking the layout and presentation of the book. It's a very nice hardback. Haven't really gotten to the rules yet, so I don't know what is different from the quick game of Fate we played before. So I'll let you know when I actually get to the rules and see what is different.
It'll probably be pretty different because I based those rules more off of the Dresden File thing than the actual Fate Core.
Right, but I kind of thought the new Fate Core was updated with kind of lessons they learned and feedback they got after using Dresden.
Very good. Well, so, Dresden was kind of like a new, a whole new edition of Fate in a way.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, I have got 5 books. So I'm pretty happy with that, and they're all decent. Not decent, better than decent. They're all good quality.
Mm.
And it's funny, before the podcast, I was trying to explain and stammering for words, and Lyle and Chris both said, I think you've forgotten how to be positive, and I think you're actually right.
Yes, and many laughs were had.
I'm still surprised that you bought it.
Yeah, me too.
Because you didn't seem too impressed with Fate when you played it, and then you bought it. And to be fair, I mean, they did offer what was a pretty good deal, and I actually bought it for Wayne through Kickstarter for whatever reason.
Right.
And I said, hey, please use Wayne's email for future correspondence. But they never did. Using mine. And they were very good about sending emails and keeping us updated.
Yeah.
Of a game I didn't buy.
Yeah.
Or want.
I've seen a couple people complain, not specifically about Fate, but about, you know, how Kickstarter creators sometimes spam the updates And it's like, you know, I kind of only want to be updated when the thing is ready to ship, or if you've hit a delay, I don't need to be updated about every little process. I mean, part of you says it's great that you are being so transparent. The other part of you just says, just update me when something major happens rather than getting 5 or 10 emails a day, which is an exaggeration, but...
Yeah, I don't want to say that they were spamming.
Right.
It was just that I wasn't actually the customer.
Mm.
It was through me.
Right.
So... I mean, those could have been major updates and really exciting updates. It just, like, I would be like, forward on the wane.
Right.
Forward on the wane.
So. No, I guess to answer your question, it was partially the deal that they were putting out. And I forget how much exactly it was, but I thought what I was getting for the price I was kicking in made it a very attractive option.
I think it was 5 books shipped to Japan.
Right.
For less than $100.
I think you're right. I think it was like...
Plus PDF copies of all of the books.
Right.
As well as PDFs of some other books that I guess weren't being printed or...
Yeah, I think there's...
quite a lot of stuff because then I got the PDF code to give to you. And that was just a massive amount. So hats off to that company. Evil Hat?
Yes.
Oh. They did provide a lot. Oh, yeah. That was unintentional. Evil Shoe? Yeah. That was intentional and not funny at all.
But no, the other reason is, even though we didn't have maybe that great of a time playing Fate before, or were kind of skeptical of the system.
Ouch.
Well, I mean, sorry, maybe that
was
a bit
harsh. We had
a
good time playing the game.
Yeah, we had a good time playing the game.
Listen to our episode on Fate.
Yeah.
It's a campaign confession, so we not only did we talk about Fate, but we also talk about Chris's adventure. I thought we were pretty positive, my recollection, of the game.
Yeah, of the game. Of the game we were, yeah, certainly. But I thought the system was at least interesting enough to give it a second try. So kind of couple that with the deal I was getting. I said, yeah, why not? And so, well, cool. We'll see what I think of it, you know, after I get through it. So, I mean, at least it's not going to be as bad as Numenera. So.
Ouch.
Oh,
wow.
Man. You're just full of barbs tonight.
Save some for the episode on that. Come on. Wow. And I get this at lunch.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, well, you know, I've read some more of it. Blah, 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 blah.
It's funny. On the new forums we put up, somebody said that it was unfair that I got pegged as the complainer because I at least have a reason.
Right.
And they specifically called you out, Lyle, and said, you just say you don't like something and leave it at that.
Oh, really?
And, yep. Yeah. But I did, you know, kind of step up for you and say, well, we are coworkers, so Lyle does hear me rant like a couple days before we actually do the podcast. So by the time we do the podcast, he's just sick of hearing me complain.
Oh, I guess I better start ranting. I'm not done saying why I don't like it.
It's not really role-play gaming. But it's video gaming. I'm playing a lot of Xbox recently because my computer broke, so I can't do my regular hobbies. So, my friend gave me an Xbox, and I've been playing a lot of that. But it's fun. I'm playing this game called Bastion, which is kind of this three-quarter look-down, just kind of a hack-and-slash game, but it's really, really fun.
Hmm.
So it's kind of like a, I don't know, it's half fantasy, half modern-ish. It's kind of like a fantastic steampunk kind of thing. There's guns and swords. kind of setting. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. Just, the quick button-mashing kind of game. But the story is thus far quite interesting, and the music is amazing, so.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I recommend anyone check it out. It's actually, it's not only Xbox. You can play it in your browser, like via Chrome or Firefox or whatever.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So I highly recommend it. It's quite fun.
I wonder what kind of load it would put on my system, though.
I don't know.
I'll have to look at it.
The map builds itself as you walk forward. I guess it's. I don't really understand why this is. I haven't gotten that far in the game yet, but you're kind of standing on an island that's floating in the sky, and as you walk forward, like pieces of the island rise up from underneath, and so it builds itself. So the map isn't already created or preloaded, so maybe that's why it's able to run quicker, as a guess, just in the dark.
Well, I mean, I guess it gets a little bit into our, you know, traditional RPGs where sometimes the system really supports the setting, and you know, the setting kind of makes sense for the mechanics that are in place. So it sounds like they might have done that for Bastion rather than attempting to, you know, slow the game down by loading a giant map all at once.
Could be, yeah.
Okay, load it piece by piece, and since we're doing that, let's come up maybe with a reason for why that happens in game, so they kind of work together. I mean, I'm not saying that's what they did, but I mean, it certainly could be.
It also has one really, really cool feature on the as well, but I'll talk about that later because that's actually my inspiration for the episode.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then I guess that's a good seg to the episode proper. And it's another installment of Inspirations, and that's where we take something, I suppose, non-tabletop role-playing game related, but has provided some sort of inspiration for a game or a gaming idea. So how about you start, Chris, since you had that interesting introduction? So something from Bastion isn't your inspiration?
So one of the most interesting, coolest features of Bastion is that it has a live narration going on while you play. And I know that kind of sounds weird because most games, you know, the narration is live anyway, but this one is, I don't want to say interactive, but in a sense it's interactive. For example, you know, as you walk forward along, the game starts and it says, like, the boy, he woke up on the island in the darkness kind of thing. And then you stand up and you start walking. And then you see your first weapon up there. He spies an old friend sitting ahead of him. And you pick up the hammer. Of course, that's just kind of the game, you know, when you reach a certain point, the narration will kick in. But it's more interactive in that, like, if I switch up weapons, instead of using the big power hammer, I switch to a machete and a rifle or something. It'll say, ah, the machete and rifle combo, nice and quick, nice and deadly. And at one point, I was there's these kind of boxes all over, and you can get little coins out of them. So I started smashing up all the boxes in the room, and he said, "You've destroyed everything around him, like he was going to get some kind of award for it." But yeah. So anyway, it's
funny.
Yeah, it's a really interesting interactive way of doing a narration, and I was thinking that that style might be really cool to bring into a game. For example, when I GM a game, I just use my regular voice to tell the characters what's going on. You know, you walk into a room. It's a 40 feet wide stone floor, stone ceiling, etc. But instead of doing that, trying to think about putting it A, in the third person, and B, kind of making an extra NPC that is the narrator of the game. So when the characters walk into a dungeon, for example, the three remaining guys, they walked into the dungeon. They saw a stone floor. It was cold. It was damp. Darkness crept in around them. That kind of thing. And I figured you could put it into kind of any aspect where you could usually do the GMing style. So describing places. If somebody rolled like a knowledge check against a ghoul, you could say, ah, the ghoul, a worthy adversary. Just don't let him touch you. Something along those lines. But I figured you could play that way. It might bring a little bit more immersion, or maybe if not immersion, a little bit more style into the game.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about that. I was thinking about maybe my favorite part of Burn Notice, which is the Michael Weston's narration.
Yeah, that really makes the show, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it does make the show, and it helps when it transitions from scene to scene.
Mm-hmm.
So I have that character. So I try to do that a little bit as the character.
Mm-hmm.
Just to do my character doing like a voiceover like that guy. But that's as a player. But yeah, that could be pretty cool. Having that, I suppose, that fictional narrator as opposed to the game master doing it, that might help the game master sort of drop their inhibitions.
Yeah.
And get into it a little bit more, whereas if they're doing it in their normal voice, they might think, oh, this is boring, or I feel self-conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But if they have this character, then they're playing a character as well.
In a sense.
And that character is the storyteller. Yeah, no, that's pretty cool. It's like The Big Lebowski.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
I was thinking that movie, too.
Yeah.
I think those are both really good points, Lyle, because, honestly, I've never actually watched an episode of Burn Notice, but I know that there is their narration, and when you were doing it in our Pathfinder game, it's kind of a way to, well, if you're being funny, yeah, as you were, you kind of lighten the mood and tell jokes, but you're also staying in character.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you kind of narrating your character's thought. And I know we've talked before about how we don't really like giving out awards or player resources for table talk. I think Lyle and I were discussing this earlier in the week, but
I think I was listening to the
person
on the forums. I don't think I've said very much.
But I see that as a way to be funny out of character, but also staying in character, right? It's kind of this third person voice. So I like that idea as a character doing it. But then, yeah, as you said, especially when you're new to role-playing, putting on a funny voice can help you kind of both get into your character more and kind of stop worrying about looking silly. You know, kind of, as you said, Lyle, drop your inhibitions and just kind of get into the character. And I hadn't thought about it until you brought it up, but the GM doesn't really have that opportunity when there's no NPCs around.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, kind of adopting, it doesn't necessarily have to be a funny voice, but adopting a voice that is, you know, appropriate for the tone of the game you're playing
mm-hmm.
would allow the GM to kind of get into it more, I think, and, you know, kind of drop their inhibitions. And I could see it working really well in a game that has been set up as, I'm at a loss for how to say this. I was going to say a story, but you know how some games you're kind of, you've set it up where, okay, we're actually playing past events. We just don't really know what happened, you know, mm-hmm. and
Or you do
like a movie thing where, you know, the book opens and, okay, let's find out what happened to this guy. And, yeah, I could see if you set a game up like that, well, then you don't really have to worry who the narrator is. It's just somebody reading the book.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to, kind of like a disembodied voice that is telling the story, but as if it were a real story instead of a game master describing a room to you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And
no, that's a good point.
You could even do something where you don't need to know who the voice is,
mm-hmm.
but as you're playing the game, you could run across an interesting NPC, and it could actually be part of the story. Like, at the end, you find out, you could even do a little, you know, montage scene or something, or the book closes, and it's this NPC, and you're like, oh, you know, I mean, I can't think of any specifics of what would be cool, mm-hmm. but you run across the right NPC who was telling the story at the end, that could be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Or
could be the bartender.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I actually thought about that in the bath just before doing the podcast. Yeah, exactly. That like somewhere along the way, as the narrator, say you walk into the bar, it's dark and cold. Why is everything dark and cold in my narration? I don't know. Anyway, and that's when they met me. And then you kind of have the NPC there. You could have a lot of fun. But, you know, one other thing that I was thinking, we've discussed before about one of the tactics used in literature of an unreliable narrator. And I was wondering, mm-hmm. I don't know, I just thought about it right before the podcast. I don't know if it would actually work or not, but this might be an avenue to introduce an unreliable narrator. If you're kind of saying that this is not me, the GM, speaking, this is the narrator, quote unquote.
So. Ghouls, give him a hug. I like it.
So I don't know if it would work or not, but, and also one of the downsides to it is that I think you have to be a little bit more on your toes and a little bit more creative than I am to be able to kind of come out in a good prose and a good story-esque kind of a description on the fly.
I'm going to disagree, because not necessarily, because I think no matter how good of an improviser you think you are, storyteller you think you are, you're always going to come up with a situation it's going to sound awkward. But
yeah.
I think people roll with it, and I think there's two things that I like about your idea, or two additional things that I like about your idea. One is, it sends a very clear signal to your players, hey, listen up,
mm-hmm.
mm.
because here's the sort of the box text.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And some, I mean, if you're changing voices, then that, as the game master, that really, really helps.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times you might be, you know, going over some rules with one player, so you're going to tune that out a little bit because it doesn't pertain to you. But then, oh, he switched to the voice, mm-hmm. the cowboy voice. So that's important. I'm gonna pay attention to that. And the other thing is, like, the cowboy voice or the, I don't know, can we say jive talking, or is that bad now?
I don't
70s African-American mm-hmm. voice.
Like you did for your noir campaign?
For noir, yeah, did the, tried to do sort of a hard-boiled novel-style narration
mm-hmm.
with a little bit of, 60s, hip talk or hipster talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would help, too, or, you know, Wayne had that 70s black exploitation game, and would... You know, if he spoke like that, how it helped bring the players into the story a bit more or into the genre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, some people don't want to do an English accent or something. So, and people seem to think English accent equals fantasy. But it's just something. You don't necessarily have to be a whiz at accents. Mm-hmm. But if you can try to do just kind of a consistent style. Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. But again, that's another good idea. When I ran a pulp game, I played the opening crawl for Indiana Jones, And we had discussed this on a prior episode about using music to signal the start of the game.
Yeah.
You know, because everybody shows up, there's, you know, table talk and just kind of regular chit-chat and stuff, and sometimes it can be hard to transition into, okay, and now let's start the game.
Mm-hmm.
But playing that opening music gets everybody ready and is a signal to, okay, and now we're playing. And using a different voice for your narration does exactly, or can do exactly, the same thing. As you said, Lyle, the players hear that cowboy voice and know, this is something I need to pay attention to. This, we're back in the game world now. We're not just discussing rules or what you want on your pizza or other stuff. This is game and I should listen.
Yeah.
So I really like that idea on a number of levels.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame that the Pathfinder game is almost finished. That's something I would really like to have used in it.
Yeah.
But, oh, well, maybe the next
one. Exactly.
The only problem is maybe because of the Big Lebowski, people are going to want to do the cowboy voice.
So yeah, yeah, yeah.
Play a cowboy game.
Like, oh, dude, it's the dude.
Yeah, I was trying to think of which voice to use for the idea, and the only other one that came up was a Morgan Freeman accent, and then I tried doing Morgan Freeman, it was just horrible, so I decided against that.
You just kind of have to talk like this. Kind of that
no,
slow
no,
voice.
No,
yeah, that was pretty
not
bad.
At all.
That's pretty bad.
Wow.
All right,
I think
all right.
You became a little less black.
I did, didn't I? How is that even possible?
I don't know. Please don't do Samuel L. Jackson.
I'm tired of these darn snakes in this darn plane.
Yeah. Well, now I know if I want to ever play a game in, like, you know, some suburb. You know, okay, Samuel L. Jackson voice. Wow, that's really white.
Yeah, you were the master at white Samuel L. Jackson.
Well, mine, I guess, kind of similar to Chris's. Mine inspiration kind of comes from a game already. And before I switched over to Fate, I was reading Numenera, and the mechanics in that game are pretty straightforward. And I don't know how I thought of this, but I thought, what if you use the Jenga tower mechanic from Dread instead of dice? So we haven't played Dread, but we have played a game by the creator of Dread, Epidaya Ravachol, Time and Temp, and we thought that was a pretty decent game, probably one of the most fun we've had at a one-shot.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Dread works is, instead of rolling dice, you have a Jenga tower. And whenever you attempt to do something, you have to pull one or more blocks from the Jenga tower, depending on the difficulty of the task you're performing. Dread is a horror game, and the tension that arises from trying to pull blocks out of this Jenga tower, from what I've heard, really not scares the player, but creates tension. And we've discussed before how tough it can be to create tension in a horror game. And I think that's a really interesting mechanic and would like to try it.
Mm-hmm.
And that just got me thinking of other things you could use besides dice to randomly generate the outcome of a task.
Mm-hmm.
Like Savage Worlds deals cards for initiative, and there's no reason you couldn't play a game with cards instead of dice. Or the other one I thought of is putting colored tokens into a bag and pulling them out. I think there's a game out there that does that, but I guess similar to Chris's narration, the mechanic you use to kind of generate this outcome, I think should mesh or at least enhance the type of game you're playing. Like, if you were using cards and you came up with like a poker mechanic, well, I would really put that in a Wild West game.
Mm-hmm.
Because it makes sense. Or, like, I don't know what you would use for, like, the stone pulling game, but the Jenga tower is tense, so put it in a horror game. And I don't know, I think that could be a lot more interesting than just rolling dice, because dice are the standard, but they don't have to be.
Okay, so the Jenga tower adds the tension because it can collapse. Or, like you said, where do you think pulling stuff from a bag or the cards, like, would that be just a substitute for dice, or do you think it would add something different?
I think it really depends on the game, and I can't think of a game or a scenario where pulling colored beads from a bag would enhance the game.
Well, you could put a lot of things off of that that colored beads mechanic, probably actually in a similar way to the cards mechanic. This is, it is in Savage Worlds, but to a greater degree in, Deadlands, the predecessor to Savage Worlds. In
right.
that, you do use cards for kind of your dice roll above or below target numbers, but in addition to that, you also can build up poker hands, and so you can get additional effects and additional kind of abilities and scores and things from what the different kinds of cards you hold and the different sets that you can make. You could do something similar with beads, assuming there's a limited number of colors. If you collect enough of the same color, that could, you know, open up some kind of special ability or power to use, or, you know, give you some extra points to spend on the game. Something along those lines.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't the original Deadlands have character creation based on drawing cards?
I actually don't know. I only know what I know about Deadlands from having read about the system. I've never actually played.
Okay, I think I started reading it, and you draw cards, and that kind of dictates what your stats will be.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe I'm wrong. But yeah, what you said about drawing colored beads, and when I was kind of thinking about the Numenera thing, you know, the natural d20 roll of a 1 is always a failure, while the natural d20 roll of a 20
mm-hmm.
is some added effect.
Yeah,
and you would of course lose that with the Jenga tower. But you could do it with cards or beads,
mm-hmm.
as you said. You know, it's real easy to put, you know, 18 beads in a bag, make one black, make one white, and the other 18 be a neutral color.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've replicated the same, you know, critical failure, critical success chance as a die, as a d20.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that gets back to the question of why not just use a die, then, if you're just going to use something else to replicate the percentage chance.
Yeah.
And that's where I guess I had a little trouble. And yeah, you would definitely want something that the theme of the randomizer enhanced or made sense for the game.
Well, one of the things that was fun with Time and Temps, actually going back to that Evadiah Ravichal thread, is that as you roll numbers on the D20, I believe, these numbers get scratched off as possible uses. So if I roll a 20, for example, I can't roll another 20 or bad things are going to happen. That
right.
kind of a mechanic, almost like a countdown or a clock mechanic, that can also be integrated, perhaps to a better degree, in cards, because cards, there's only 52 in the deck. You know, when those are up. You know, when this bag is empty of beads, maybe that's time up. That's when you have to end or the world explodes or something like that. So there's definitely things that you can do with those systems that you can't do without. And I think kind of a sense of timeliness or almost a clock mechanic is one of the biggest and easiest ones to fit into it.
Hmm.
I've seen a couple other ones. There's this one game that I've been dying to take a closer look at. I just haven't had the time. It's called Cave Master by Jeff D. He's a game designer in the States. And it's playing cavemen, and I think he calls it stonepunk. But it's played with, it's an extremely thematic system to it, in that you have kind of a piece of hide with three circles drawn on it. And I believe the circles, sorry if I get this wrong, as kind of strength, mind, and stamina. And you roll sticks and stones or whatever you have found about in nature onto the mat, and where they land on the different circles kind of determines your roll to that. So it's... I don't know about if it's actually a good system or not. I don't know enough about it, but it's definitely very thematic for playing a caveman. So I love the
Absolutely.
Idea.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
That does sound really cool.
Mm.
Yeah, just back what Wayne was talking about. Yeah, I guess if you were just replicating the dice and what the dice was doing by, like, putting the beads back into the bag, then, yeah, I wouldn't see much point in doing that. But if it was some sort of, as Chris was saying, you know, you don't replace the beads, so you're actually running out of, like, positive beads.
Mm.
And you're getting down to the negative, and you can sort of play with what's left and the percentages, then that could be fun. It would certainly be different than a lot of the games, though.
Right.
Because they're built on everything resetting every time you, like, the chances are the same
right.
each time. Whereas this is, it's becoming increasingly more difficult or more easier.
Right.
I mean, if you use up all the bad ones.
Now, it wasn't a role-playing game, but one of the games I played recently was Yggdrasil. And that had a similar mechanic. It's a cooperative game similar to Flashpoint or Pandemic,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you're the Norse gods trying to prevent the Ragnarok from coming about.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take actions to collect souls from some of the different worlds, and how you do that is you draw a number of tokens from an opaque bag, and some of them are fire giants, which you put back into the bag, and some of them are Vikings, which you keep and can then spend as like power tokens to make your roles more effective later on in the game. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty cool, because the different worlds had different percentages, at least at the start of the game, of fire giants and Vikings.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you took Vikings out, well, obviously, you know, you have a less chance of drawing them. So it was interesting to remember, okay, which was kind of the bad bag that we shouldn't draw from, which was the more advantageous bag. And, of course, certain characters had an ability where, you know, they could look at a certain number and, you know, take out fire giants or put Vikings back in. So, mm-hmm. again, it would take a lot of mathematics and tweaking the game. But, yeah, if there was something where the probabilities changing made thematic sense for the game, then, yeah, I could see using it.
Yeah, I think in a horror-style system like Dread, that kind of countdown where the tension is intended to build up over the course of the game really works out well for that. But for other games, it might be breaking down the fourth wall a little more than the game is designed for. I'm thinking in, for example, a D&D game, it's a one-shot happens, but in a campaign kind of thing, if you ratchet up the tension every session, it kind of, it doesn't make a flow between the sessions very well, so I'm not sure it would work very well for that kind of a game specifically, but then again, of course, that's why it uses dice instead.
Right.
I don't know, I've been trying myself thinking about trying to do a game with a bidding mechanic for it, but I can't actually figure out how to make it work, so I don't know.
Hmm. Getting back to Fate, one of the add-on products for the Fate Kickstarter was a deck of Fate that was a deck of cards that replicated four fudge dice. You know, they had the same probabilities of the -4 to +4.
Mm-hmm.
But they were a little bit different in that they had adjectives, I think like 2 or 3 adjectives on the card. So it wasn't just pulling a card instead of rolling dice. It was pulling a card and there was a little bit extra information on there, or kind of things to spark ideas about what happened because of the roll. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get it, but thinking about it now, it could be interesting rather than just rolling the dice.
It seems to fit very well with Fate, how you kind of make the story as you go along.
Well, like, West End Games Torg use cards in addition to a D20.
Hmm.
Okay, the interesting thing about the cards is that there are additional things that you can spend while you're rolling.
Right.
So it made the roll more dramatic. And the idea was to make the game a more dramatic game, more pulpy, more fun.
Mm-hmm.
People are more involved. So, I mean, there's nothing to say that you can't combine mechanics.
Yeah,
right.
Very true.
So you could be drawing from the bag, and depending on what color bead you get, has some impact on the role, or can color the social interaction. It can be some sort of the beads in the bag could be coloring the situation, whereas your die is related to your individual actions. But like Chris said, it you would really have to think about how to introduce that into a game that didn't already have it.
Mm-hmm.
We were even thinking about whether or not to use 2d10s as opposed to a d20 in Pathfinder.
Right, right.
But so many things are built upon it being, hey, it's a d20, not a 2d10, that we opted to just stick with the d20.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Despite the same values coming out of it, it's amazing how different the math turned out for everything.
Right. It is not an idea that you could just kind of drop into a game with no thought.
Hmm.
That's true.
Well, for my inspiration, I'll go to a book, and that's Richard Adams Shardik. And Richard Adams is the guy who wrote Watership Down and Plague Dogs.
Oh, right. Okay. I thought I'd heard the name before.
Yeah.
And this was the book that he wrote after Watership Down. And it's about a bear, and a little bit more than a bear. It's
a large bear.
But only a little bit large.
Well, I'm only about 200 pages into the novel, and the bear is seen as an avatar for the god.
Hmm.
Now, whether or not it actually is, he's done a good job of making you wonder, is it really, or is it just a bear, or is it actually an avatar?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And people worship this bear, and these particular group of people think that it gives them power. So the appearance of Shardik, or Lord Shardik, which is the appearance of this large bear, mm-hmm. sets off a course of actions. But what I really liked about it is the use of animals to form a religion.
Okay.
And here, for all intents and purposes, it's like a real animal. It's not like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where you have talking animals.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It acts like a bear. It's larger than the average bear, but it still acts like a bear.
Oh,
it's
larger than the average bear?
Yeah, I was going to say, does he live in Jellystone Park, too? Sorry.
Is he larger than the average bear?
No, he's smarter than, but it's just large, more than the average bear.
Than the average bear. You can't pass that up. Sorry.
Hey, boo-boo.
Exactly.
Yeah, I forgot to mention boo-boo, the other avatar.
Well, sorry to interrupt, but out of curiosity, since Adams wrote Watership Down, and you said this bear is, or the animals in this book are acting like real animals and not simply talking animals as they are in Narnia.
Yeah.
Is it like Watership Down where they are realistic animals?
No.
Just with a voice. Okay.
No, and actually I thought that's what I thought it would be, and it does, not to spoil things. It starts off with just focusing on the animals. Mm-hmm. But none of them are speaking it. They're just narrating what's happening with these animals.
Hmm.
Especially the bear. And it doesn't speak. And I was like, oh, I wonder if the bear's going to start to speak now. Or when's the bear going to start to speak? But it actually focuses on the humans, the ones that worship the bear.
Hmm.
And the story is told from their perspective and, their relationship with Shardik, as opposed to Shardik getting thinking time or speaking time.
Mm-hmm. Does Shardik have any camera time? I mean, apart from the introduction?
He's introduced, and then it switches to the humans, and it hasn't given him like a spotlight.
Okay.
It's always him in relationship to the humans.
Hmm.
So when he appears is when the humans go out and seek him.
Right.
And how they interact with them. And while they worship them, one guy says, a bear is a bear.
Right.
Which reminded me a lot of Life of Pi, where they're talking about whether or not animals feel like people,
mm-hmm.
have the same feelings and have the same emotions, and sometimes we'll project their own onto in this case, in the Life of Pi, the tiger.
Mm-hmm. Mm, right.
But the tiger's not human, and he or she doesn't think of you in the same way. It'll eat you the first chance it gets.
Right.
And there's people with that view about the bear. It's like, it's a bear. It's a very important totem for us, but it is still a bear.
Hmm.
And the other people, Shardik is a bear, but its appearance means something. And others think it has, it can think and has some sort of more advanced intellect, so therefore it will make decisions.
Right.
So there's all those different perspectives among the humans, but still, just that idea of, they've built this religion around this totem of the bear, but the bear makes an appearance, and when the bear goes away, and that, misfortune will befall them, and things like that. But that kind of religion, I thought was pretty interesting.
Now, that is pretty interesting, because, as you said, you're 200 pages in, and you, the reader, do not know which perspective is the correct one. And we've kind of talked about this before in relationship to religion. I think a lot of times religion has to have that ambiguity, because that is the whole nature of faith, kind of believing with no evidence or with a lack of proof.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, the lack of proof that you say you are getting in that book, it sounds like it's doing a good job of, setting up and maintaining that religion. So that does sound pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's something where, and we've talked about this in a few episodes, faith in a gaming world, and if people are getting powers, or you have like a druid, not to pick on D&D or anything like that, but...
but it deserves it.
Right. I didn't say that, so,
I did.
I'm not complaining about D&D, so I don't have to justify why I said not to pick up. But, you have people like druids who are magical, and they can shape change, and they can do all these wondrous things, and they have beast companions. So, I mean, if you have something like an animal that didn't do anything in that kind of world, when you have all these gods that actually do or give powers to the animals, or powers to the animals or powers to the people, then it might not work. But if you have a world that's a little bit low magic, and just what people will do for this avatar, and it doesn't necessarily need to be an animal.
Right.
But if you as a game master can make it where it's a little ambiguous whether or not it does have power.
Hmm.
Hmm.
Because there's one thing, again, not a spoiler, where the bear attacks a guy who happens to be carrying an important message for the opposition.
Hmm.
Now, a bear can just attack somebody, but then they're like going, no, no, what, you know, the person was going to call out to warn the rider because they didn't know it was who he was.
Right.
And she fell, so she couldn't call out in time, and then the bear attacked him. And it turned out the bear did, if you're on that side, the right thing. It attacked right. somebody who could have damaged them or harmed them. So they're like, okay, like this happened because this, this, this. So they're able, you know, to justify, you know, just as we do with, you know, regular religion.
Right.
You know, we think of this idea of karma. We think, oh, you know, this good thing happened to me because of a good thing I did 2 weeks ago.
Right.
This bad thing happened because I did something bad yesterday.
I think that's a really interesting idea, and I would like to try it. However, in my experience, players are notorious for wanting concrete answers. And I think personally, if I was running a game like that as a GM, I would have trouble keeping things ambiguous or having events that could be viewed as simple coincidences or as, you know, signs of faith or fate.
Mm. You can plan a lot of stuff like that, that writer carrying a message. That's not hard at all to plan in the beginning, but it is hard to plan for player-driven eventualities. You know, if they have a question about this bear, the players, if that's what they're interested in, they'll probably go looking for the bear. You know, they won't go about their regular business waiting for the bear to appear or not appear. And I'm sure there's more than a few groups who will say, all right, well, if this bear is some kind of avatar, then he'll be pretty hard to kill. Let's go see.
Oh, actually, he's covered himself. You actually can kill the bear.
Mm-hmm.
It'll die as easily as any other bear. Well, any other bear that's larger.
Yes.
And that's one of the stories why they had the misfortune in the past. So therefore, they have very fanatical people that would protect the bear. And I don't want to make this... I mean, having the animal avatar, it can be pretty exciting, but just having something like that right. as an avatar, I mean, ways around it is you make it where you can't play the priest class.
Mm.
Or you make it where the priest class gets certain powers, but they're not magical powers or fate powers.
Just powers of authority?
Yeah, powers of authority. Mm-hmm. They're perhaps more knowledgeable than the other people around them. Maybe they're privy to certain secrets and certain powers, but they're not necessarily faith powers.
Right.
Yeah. And the priesthood can build it as like, well, people who know the inner workings of the faith, I mean, they're very, very high up. So, it could be in some incentive for the player character to advance in that regard.
So you just suggested people play Scientologists.
No, I was thinking with that idea, the way I would play it in a campaign is that if you're basing your religion kind of off of the signs of an animal, it seems pretty random. You know, if this animal comes out of the forest at a certain point, then, you know, this prediction will come true versus another one. But on the other hand, animals aren't completely random. You know, they behave for some reasons or another. I was thinking maybe take it where the priesthood or like the nobility are maybe controlling the animal or trying to manipulate the animal. You know, they're putting food in a certain spot so that it goes to a favorable position, or they've imported a trained one from another place. And if you took that with a society that actually believed in this religion, then all hell could break loose, you know? People could be angry on one side that they're manipulating what they see as gods, or it might cause a schism where some people stop believing in the religion. You could make a really interesting kind of sandbox campaign just around what an animal does.
I have to think about that more, because my first kind of knee-jerk reaction was someone is controlling the animal or they're manipulating the animal. I'm like, well, then that kind of answers the question of faith. I mean, I guess me being the pessimistic person I am, you know, if I was in that society and found out someone had been controlling this totem or this kind of avatar, well, then my kind of gut reaction would be, well, it's fake, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of the players would go that way. They'd be like, oh, well, okay, we don't have to believe anymore because it's not true. It's being manipulated. So, mm-hmm. I don't know, that's kind of why I mentioned, like, I personally would have a hard time as a game master setting up events or even just narrating events so that they were ambiguous. I think the things I would narrate would come off as being either completely divine or completely mundane.
Oh, or unless maybe you go into it without having made the decision yourself.
That's a possibility.
Maybe.
I mean, you're focusing on, you keep going back to the ambiguity.
Right.
And it doesn't really need to be where you as a game master are creating ambiguous actions or ambiguous turn of events.
Mm.
Therefore, they have to wonder, is that coincidence or does have power? But it just says, like, I mean, animal totems have been around for a long time. And I guess the temptation has been to, you know, even though I would imagine they didn't really give anybody powers, that when we do it in a game, then we're like, okay, so you worship the bear, then you're going to get +2 to your strength.
Right.
Or you'll be able to do this. But you're like, no, it doesn't give you anything, really. But these people worship it, and they think it's very important. I mean, you think about, not too versed in Hinduism, but if you think about India and the way they view beef and the cow, and it's just something that you need to be aware of when you're in that culture. There's a certain level of respect. I mean, if you have a culture that worships elephants, and they treat elephants with a certain respect, when elephants come through...
What does that mean? You know,
they trample through. People don't try to stop them, don't try to kill them. If the player characters do kill them or accidentally kill them, then that's a problem. And to go with something like that, in this case, the bear could probably wander wherever and you're going to have people protecting it, but other people would, you know, maybe try to kill it. But, I mean, there are consequences to that. Mm-hmm. People then, you know, society would collapse even though it's just a bear.
Right.
And do that. But whereas you have like the avatar of a particular god, if Odin's walking around, yeah, you can't kill him. Or Zeus, you can't kill him.
And he
has all these powers. So it's like, well, yeah, gods exist and there's definitely a pecking order. But here there's some sort of elaborate religion based on what could be nothing.
Right.
But it to them, it is a very powerful religion. And that creates a certain amount of tension within the society as people who, I'm not going to say anything about the bear. But what I really believe is that it's just the bear. A bear is a bear. And in some countries, they hunt bears. And that there is that tension where people don't believe it.
Mm.
But, I mean, they're helpless at the time, or they can't do anything at the time. Or if somebody's using the bear to give them power, then how do they get around that?
Mm-hmm.
Do they poison the bear? And said, oh, well, you tried to protect the guy. Or you tried to protect the bear, and it didn't work under your, you know, you let Lord Shardik die.
Right. No, I think I focus on the ambiguity because that's the part that I thought was interesting. But, yeah, you saying that, and it, you could expand that out to just natural phenomenon. You know, not it doesn't have to be an animal. It could be like, you know, a tornado or flood or something, or perhaps something less destructive. But I don't, not that I don't, but it could be hard to do that with PCs, you know, because the players would have to buy into one of those kind of trains of thought, or one of those schools of thought, you know, and they would have to care about the fictional religion that you've put up. But I could see that being a group of NPCs that the players have to deal with. Hmm. And as you said, like, okay, whatever the avatar is a natural phenomenon, which means it could be a divine sign, it could be just natural things, but how people react to it is going to be more important than kind of what the thing actually did. And I think that would be interesting.
Yeah, you know what I was thinking with that? I think this actually happened in history where there was a comet or something that could be seen really easily at night, but there's a lot of mass hysteria around it. Sorry, my history is failing me here. But if you did something like that where there was, I don't know, the moon appeared red for a month, or there was a comet in the sky, something along those lines, where you would tell the players, kind of out of character, that this is significant to the story, but that's all you tell them. And then actually in the story, there are, you know, a whole bunch of different, there's some churches think that it's a sign of the end times. Some churches think that it's a sign to go to war with the next thing. Some church thinks that it's a time of coming peace, and the nobility thinks it's, you know, good for them. The peasantry are scared. Just they have all these different kind of viewpoints, and the players have to, A, figure out which one is right, or try and keep everybody from, you know, society from collapsing on itself, or something along those lines. It'd be a lot of fun.
I think we underestimate the power of superstitions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the Romans, who were, I suppose, to be, you could say they were slightly cynical about the gods, per se, but they had a lot of superstitions.
Right.
Where they wouldn't want to go to battle with them until they saw the proper signs from, I believe it was chicken innards.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when we did the divination episode where, you know, hey, read those goat intestines again. Okay,
yeah.
Well, they're not favorable. Okay,
kill another goat.
And keep going. So.
Yeah, and there's a novel about Cicero, which is pretty good because it has the head priest, and there has to be, he has to see birds or something before they can call the vote for the consul.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he's like, you saw a bird, right? And somebody's like, oh, I don't think I saw it. No, I think we did. All right, let's get this started. You know, the looking for the favorable augurs. But, you know, all of that is just, you. I mean, the bear does stuff. And we just keep going back to the bear just because it was the inspiration. But right. It does something, and there's certain people in power that can interpret what that means. Mm. And whether or not the player characters are going to be like, well, I want to go kill the bear. Okay, but it would be kind of like you have a Roman game, and you're trying to play kind of a realistic Roman game, and the people are like, well, I'm just going to go to battle. Well, you haven't checked the augurs.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't give me any bonuses. And it's like, well...
Your troops then aren't
your soldiers,
you.
Yeah, they're going to be like, well, I guess we're going to lose the battle then.
So. It's like when we did Vikings. Remember, it's supposedly like really, really bad luck to loot armor and equipment off of a dead body because the armor did not do a good job of protecting its previous wearer.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. I forgot that.
And the examples that they gave were, well, yeah, you really could play it up and have it be supernatural where now the person is unlucky and the mechanics reflect that. Or it's like, well, you could play it up where it's more psychosomatic and you could go either way. Like, you still have mechanical penalties. They're not really because you're unlucky, but because you believe you are unlucky and kind of ends up being the same thing. Or you could just play it up as a fictional kind of thing where it's something you would not do just because this is something your culture does not do. It's so bad luck to do that no one would ever think about doing that.
Well, play up the psychology. I mean, you get, you know, the goat innards tell you that, you know, all signs point to success, then you're going to get that psychological bonus because you're going to will yourself. But if you're going to ignore signs that say, no, this is a bad thing, then it's whether or not, you know, you try to tell yourself, I'm a rational man or woman. You know, I'm not going to believe in, you know, some intestines on the floor. But if you're raised in that culture, you're going to be, but, you know, it's going to be in the back of your mind. You're always going to second guess. Yeah. I was thinking about Chris's game as well. You know, there's the sacrifice to the white dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris has done an interesting story where there's a little bit of mystery there. It was more of a political thing, the steal. So that adds a nice dimension to that particular story. But you could also spin it as this society worships this white dragon and they send up these sacrifices and, you know, maybe the white dragon doesn't even know or doesn't care that they're there.
Mm-hmm.
But they've developed this religion around the white dragon and hunters come, well, we're going to kill the white dragon. Every now and then it ravages your town, you know, so you should be worshiping us. No, no. But think of all the years that we've had a good harvest.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
It's protecting us. Just using that example.
Oh, I should have used that.
No, I like. No, I'm certainly not suggesting that it should have been done in your game. I'm just saying, just using a recent example for us, because what you did is you had a political thing, which then creates a mystery because what's being done now is not politically expedient. So it's kind of a political game with a white dragon.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's something else. But we always complain. Players don't make enough about religion, except if it directly benefits them.
Mm.
But what powers does the Catholic Church have? Like, why have the Catholic Church or ministries or the Jewish faith in a modern world? If you're going to play a modern game and somebody comes to you with, hey, I got a religious character. Oh, okay, great.
We're not playing D&D, right? Oh, man.
Yeah.
I thought I could get, like, I don't even get Cure Light Wounds. No. What do I get? Here's your Bible. That's it.
Yeah, it's just true. You know, when the clerics have to pray in the morning to get their spells, how many people actually pay attention to that prayer, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and playing a paladin who has to do that, like, I know why they do it mechanically. Actually, I don't, because all it does is you kind of have to not waste an hour, but it's like, okay, I get up an hour earlier than everyone else.
Mm.
Okay. And that took all of 2 seconds to narrate, so...
Would you want him to do it in real time,
I certainly would not. I certainly would not. Yeah. No, I would not.
No, but it is a good point, and it's not that you have to pray for an hour, but, you know, how many people develop their own little prayers that they can say in battle or just before battle, or they get fear and they're going to call to their God. When I was watching Brooklyn's Finest, which is a fine movie, so I don't have to get into too much detail about it, you know, they had a very deeply religious character, and I thought that added a lot of depth to that character.
Hmm.
So when they do bad things, they were trying to... you know, reconcile it with their Catholic faith. But if, you know, if a player comes to you, my character's a Catholic, and you're like, oh, okay, is there any vampires? No. Oh, okay, change it, then he's atheist, he's agnostic, it doesn't matter.
It's not a very deep movie, but you also have something like the Boondock Saints, where they are doing their kind of thing because of their faith, rather in spite of.
No, I think that's a good example, yeah. And I think again, yeah, it's not a deep movie, but it's enjoyable.
The
two leads are good in it. Yeah, but that the fact that they're Irish Catholics or Irish American Catholics does add a little bit to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And the story does something with it.
I think maybe that's the key, is that the story actually does something with it, regardless of what the it is.
Mm-hmm. Not to be reductionist, but it goes kind of down to our mantra, you know? If you want to put it in, make it matter.
Right.
Yeah. And if people just want to read a good book, then Shardik would be that.
And if people just want to play a good game, Bastion is that. And if people want another good game, Jenga.
Well, yeah.
So that wraps up our second Inspirations episode. So for those who didn't catch our first one, you can catch it under, hey, Inspirations 1, I believe.
An inspired title.
Yeah, well, certainly was prescient because we predicted that we were going to do a 2. And I had a chance to check out those comments about me not elaborating on my complaint. So expect more on Firefly in the future.
And for people who thought I like to complain, Lyle's going to steal that crown from
me. Oh, yeah. I'm just going to be like, all right, guys, you might want to go get a drink or something for the next 15 minutes.
I don't know. In Lyle's defense there, you do like to complain. You do have good reasons. I'll give you that. But yeah.
I do.
Man, I don't even hate Firefly. I didn't know I had to like elaborate on why. I thought it was okay.
No, you have to elaborate because Firefly is a fantastic series. You have no excuse for not liking it. I'm sorry.
Just change the lyrics of that one song and he don't like Firefly. We'll be talking about Lyle.
That's right. I'm never going to date you, Lyle.
It's working.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or stream it through Stitcher or iTunes or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, post comments on the website, send us an email. We always love hearing from all of you. And, of course, again, we are part of the Happy Jacks forums now. Thank you again, everybody from Happy Jacks. You can get there, join up, and post messages to us, discuss with us at idleredhands.com/forum. So, see you in next time.
Bye.
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 Drive Through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive Through RPG, the one true source for RPGs. We'll be right back.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.